From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
And welcome once again to the show for board gaming dorks by board gaming dorks. That'll be us. My name's Trent.
And I'm Mark.
And this is a show called The Dice Men Cometh, and you are listening to it via the electric wireless, broadcast through Edge Radio 99.3 FM in Hobart, Tasmania, Australia, Southern Hemisphere.
The world.
Our local solar group, I could go on, but I shan't. Or you're podcasting it or streaming it or any one of a variety of ways. There's actually more ways to listen to this show
than is necessary.
I know. Like, you showed me that we've got a page on Board Game Geek.
Yeah, with all the with every episode up there, except the missing magic episode.
Who did that? I didn't do that.
The gnomes of the internet do that.
What's coming up in tonight's show?
Tonight we have a special guest via interview, Paul Dean, famous from the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast.
He's our kind of famous.
Yeah.
He's board game famous.
Oh, absolutely.
With a small F.
In the podcast board gaming world, he is one of the dudes. Anyway, Trent spoke to him earlier in the week about a project he's involved with on Kickstarter, Paranoia role-playing game, the re-release of that classic from the 80s. We're also going to do a fantastic, oh, spoiler alert, a review. I wonder what we thought of it, of Too Many Cinderellas by Grail Games, currently on Kickstarter. All that and more, some half-assed news, and we run out of uke for once.
You can never have enough uke. Hey, you know, next week for the 50th episode.
Oh, the 50th!
We should. Shall I bring in the ukulele and do all that live?
Let's do uke live.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let's get the show started in the right note with, I'm going to play another track off the new Machine Head album, Bloodstones and Diamonds. This one's called Game Over.
Yeah.
Although we're just getting started, really. Game over, man. Game over. On Edge Radio, 99.3 FM, that is from the new Machine Head. I'm listening to that a lot right now. And, hey, if you like that kind of thing, maybe you can realise why. If not, then, you know, well, I can't help you.
It's full on, that's for sure.
Trent and Mark on the Dice Men Cometh. Tonight, talking board games and card games for a change.
And, you know what? I hate flat pack furniture.
What?
I've been putting together a chest of drawers today. I hate flat pack furniture. Anyway, moving on. Look, I'm going to keep my powder dry as far as what I've been playing until we come to my review later on in the show.
Oh, yes.
Of Too Many Cinderellas.
Yes, which is currently on Kickstarter. Mm. Okay.
So we're going to talk about that more. But, Trent, what have you been playing?
Funny you should ask that.
totally out of the blue, that question.
Well, I've had a little bit of an epiphany, actually, Mark.
Is it better now?
I've applied ointment, and I think I'm ready to move on. I played Archipelago last week. We love Archipelago.
Yes, yes.
The game of colonial expansion.
Racism.
Which is, yeah, maybe slightly racist. Yeah. You know, putting down, building towns and ports and ships and things,
yeah,
and exploiting
many
the South Sea Islands. I lost really, really badly.
You sound surprised.
It's not that I lost, it's how much I lost by.
Oh, okay.
I scored, and I kid you not, 1 point.
Oh, you're kidding.
In this game of
you're
Archipelago.
Kidding.
One.
Don't you
point.
Get 1 point for turning up?
Not only that, I was actually, because of course there are hidden goals in Archipelago.
Yeah.
And I had the goal that's like, okay, well, you win if everybody else loses, if the natives rise up.
Yeah.
And so I was the rebel / betrayer card. And I flipped this over and like the guys I'm playing with are like, oh, you're kidding? You could have won ages ago.
Really?
I'm like, really? Because I'm not seeing it. Obviously, I can't figure it out. So I've decided that's it. Just no more Archipelago. I'm just not going to play again.
Yeah.
I'm never, ever going to play the game again.
I've never been the betrayer. Now, how do you win if you're the betrayer?
You just got to manipulate.
Make too many natives. The natives overpower the white guys.
I don't know why
guys.
You're asking me, because clearly I
don't know. Yeah.
Okay? But this raises the question, what do you do when you love a game that you suck at?
What do you do?
Well, I had to go back to my economic theory
yes.
for this, okay? Because what you've got there is you've got what economists call a sunk cost, which is the time and the money if those two things are equal, that you've put into the game, okay, in order to learn it, which makes quitting it hard. But then you've got the opportunity cost, right? Which
so
is
you could be learning a new game in that same amount of time.
For every hour I waste my time losing Archipelago, all right? Or to put it another way, a winner never quits and a quitter never wins, but I haven't quit and I'm not winning, so why am I bothering? So, no more Archipelago, no more complicated Euro economic games. I'm not built for it.
You've crossed the J curve of Euro economic games.
And I played on the weekend something that is so far up my alley, I'm amazed that I haven't gotten to it earlier.
Oh, really?
Survive Escape from Atlantis.
Yes.
Right. This is a little family game that is just right in my wheelhouse. Yeah. It came out in 1982, this thing, and it has been perpetually in print. Asmodee currently have it. It's an island of hex tiles, and it's, lo and behold, sinking.
Yes.
And each player removes a tile at a time. Each player has a group of people that they're trying to move off the island to the shore with a boat, if they're lucky. And in the meantime, there's sharks and whales and sea serpents and stuff. This sounds like fun.
Yeah, it is.
This sounds like a lot more fun than exploiting the natives in some unnamed South Seas archipelago.
Getting chewed on by a sea serpent.
It's quick to learn, and it is bloody cutthroat.
Yes.
It is a nasty cutthroat game. The rules get out of the way and let the players start to hurt each other. And what's more, it's also really house rulable. Like, the guys I was playing were playing with, they don't normally like a lot of conflict in the game, so they almost virtually play it as a co-op game. I like a little bit more friction in there. But it actually withstands some house ruling. You can change it up.
Okay.
It's a big hit with me. Survive Escape from Atlantis. Two thumbs up from Trent.
I've played it, and I like it. And it's funny because I do like the backstabbiness of it, the fact that you can really shaft someone.
And it looks great as well.
Yeah,
you know?
It is. The great little sharks and everything like that.
And there's an expansion with a giant squid in it that can actually pull the guys who you've gotten to safety back into the water. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I can't imagine it with no conflict, though. I'm really, that's actually doing my head in a little bit.
Now, look, I do realise that it is a little bit of a step down from Archipelago, crunchy economic game to survive Escape from Atlantis, but I made my decision and I'm sticking to it.
Hang on, does that mean no Kanban?
You know, all right, what's the correct pronunciation, please?
Kanban!
Thank you. This is the Japanese game of automotive manufacturing. I don't think I'm up to looking at that game. I mean, it's just a nightmare mess of things to do, and it's stressing me out just thinking about it. I think I'm getting an ulcer.
You don't have a lot of downtime and analysis paralysis on games like Survive as well, because usually it's pretty obvious. Like, what can I do for maximum screwage this turn? But there it is.
What do we game for? What do we play games for, Mark? Right? We do
for
it
for fun.
We do it for fun to hang out with our mates and to talk crap at each other. And particularly for me,
trash talking is
you know, one of the things I enjoy most. I'm usually at the receiving end of it, of course. If I'm playing something like Archipelago, which, let's face it, is just a bit of an intellectual wank.
Yeah, there's not much trash talking Archipelago. Oh, well, how could you take the pineapples?
All right, now Mark's been playing lately a little Kickstarter called Too Many Cinderellas from Grail Games, and we're going to talk about that in depth next, and then we get to our interview with Paul Dean from Shut Up and Sit Down here on the Dice Men Cometh, Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Teen Mum and their song, I Want to Go Out on... I know, it's great. I totally sympathise. I get it. I want to go out too.
You should try being a 40-something single dad. I want to go out.
Why do you think we're staying at home playing stupid board games all night?
That's right.
Anyway, it's Edge Radio 99.3 FM with Trent and Mark. And we're going to talk about the Kickstarter for the 80s RPG Paranoia, which has had a significant reboot and is now on Kickstarter. And also now on Kickstarter, a little Australian game called Too Many Cinderellas from our mate, David Harding.
Yeah, from Grail Games.
Who did 101.
That's
which
right.
We talked about previously.
And Elevensies for one. Yeah.
So there's these little card games that this guy kind of, it's his wheelhouse, isn't it?
Yeah, well this, you know, David said when we interviewed him before that not only did he want to bring out his own games, because 101 and Elevensies for one were his own designs, but he wanted to bring out some, you know, hence the name, Grail Games, from other people that hadn't yet seen the light of day. And I remember we had the discussion about this new trend of Japanese minigames, which Love Letter has been the champion for.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, a game that has minimal components, a handful of cards, whatever, but will play in 15, 20 minutes, but actually will have a level of depth of strategy in it.
That's right. Usually some kind of semi-interesting story around the theme and some kind of plot twist to it. And it just seems that Japan is this hotbed of innovation at the moment, particularly around these small games.
Yeah. So, look, this game, Too Many Cinderellas. So it is a Japanese design, designed by Nao Shimamura and Nobutake Dogen. With illustrations.
I love how you're pretending you know what you're doing.
Illustrations by Hinami Sukuda. and apologies to all my Japanese friends for that poor pronunciation. Hey! So David has got this Japanese game and he's reworked it a bit. Not a lot. Mm. So the artwork, I think, is kept very much as in the Japanese style.
Yep.
But they've changed not so much the mechanics, but the icons, and I'll get to that in a minute.
And this thing is completely language independent.
There's hardly any words on the cards at all. So now it's on Kickstarter, and it is, I think, 18 cards, a handful of tokens. It'll also come, if they get to the certain stage, it'll come with diamonds just to count who wins how many rounds, because a little bit like Love Letter, you can play multiple rounds.
And we were thinking, because we sat down to play this, here we go, this is just going to be just like Love Letter, but it's actually a quite different experience.
Yeah, very different, actually. So I should tell the story. You know, it's funny, we've had this back and forth a bit about ethics in journalism and game reviews and everything like that. So, you know, fun...
We don't want to get caught up in game.
No, that's right. So, I actually reached out to David and said, oh, look, is there any way we can get a copy? Not looking to, you know, feather our own nest or anything. But David was very kind to actually send his own copy over to us by express post.
I know.
So we could play it. I sent it back today. You'll get it tomorrow,
he's
David.
He's only got one copy.
Yeah, that's right. I sent it back and, look, so we got together last night. We mm-hmm. pulled this out. We talked it through. We played it. We had a ball. The story is basically that you are Prince Charming, you've been to the ball, you've met the love of your life, of course you had a few drinks, you sort of forgot what she looked like, and you know, you've got this slipper, and basically you're trying to find who was the love of your life.
So you're asking all the servants and the other attendees at the ball, who was this person?
Yeah, you're sort of trying to narrow down who she is. And so what you have is you have the ability on the cards. The cards have a picture. They have these icons which indicates each of these people who are potential candidates mm-hmm. to marry the prince, what they like. And then, but then on the bottom of the card, they have what they call a rumour, which is something like that the princess or the bride-to-be is not young or does not like a certain thing.
Or doesn't have brown hair or doesn't drink wine.
Yeah.
Was another one, yeah.
Now, I'm going to come to the alcohol thing in a minute.
Oh, yes.
So the cards basically have two roles to play. One is as a potential marriage candidate and one is as a rumour. So when you play them, you play the rumour. So basically you're narrowing down what Cinderella isn't.
Mm.
And the other interesting thing is you have two tokens. You have a no token and an okay. So you sort of play in secret one of these two tokens, no or yes. So if you play your no, what you're saying is no, that rumour isn't going to come into effect.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to keep your options open so that when you get to the end and you're only playing two cards each, you've got at least one person left in your hand that can fulfil the requirements of what the princess is. In other words, they're not any of the thing that the princess, that the Cinderella isn't, if that makes sense. Now, I might have jumbled it up a bit, but it's actually really simple once you work it out. And so the interesting thing was on these cards, which is from the Japanese version, the Cinderella can either like wine or beer, or there is one card which is a cat, which is a cat in a wig.
Yes.
And, of course, the cat likes milk, funnily enough. You can
actually get Prince Charming to marry the cat.
Yeah, yeah.
If you play your cards right at the end
and,
of the game.
And you know, we did chat to David just to hammer out some questions we had, and he'd tell us that they have actually replaced the alcohol in the new version with cake and ice cream and things like that. Look, potentially there are some people out there, wowzers, who could be turned off by having alcohol in the game, by saying, oh, the princess has to like wine or has to like beer.
It's all very innocent.
Actually, I think my princess would have to like wine and beer.
Although there is a cross-dressing princess in there, isn't there?
I won the third game and therefore the whole shebang by marrying the old man to the prince.
Well, you know, look, it was a big night and, you know, clearly some of his inhibitions had
they got on really well.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope they're very happy together.
Yeah, look, and it's great to see that, you know, that Cinderella can be a man.
And I had the Prince Charming marrying the young boy at one point and that felt a bit weird.
Yeah.
That one was a bit strange. But Too Many Cinderellas was an absolute hit
for
us.
We really enjoyed it and, you know, as we said, it fills a niche that that Love Letter also fills of that quick game, but it's not the same game. It's very different, and I think if you're looking for something to fill that filler gap, you can't play Love Letter forever. This is fantastic, and look, I have put my money where my mouth is, and I will declare my conflict of interest in that I have backed this, and I've actually backed for two copies now. I've upped my back to two copies.
Oh, that's nice of you to get me one, Mark.
Which is, you know, it is your birthday coming up soon, Trent, I'm sure, or Christmas or something like that. Look, $16 for one copy.
And that's posted anywhere in the world.
$30 for two copies. It has 21 days to go. It's at 36% at the moment. I'd love to see this get over the line, nonetheless because I want to be able to get it myself. But I think it's a great little game. It's great to see these sort of fabulous games coming to light of day, particularly with an Australian group.
Australia, Australia, Australia!
That's right. So, oi, oi, oi. So, look, if you like Love Letter particularly, and even if you don't like Love Letter, I would recommend you get on board this Kickstarter. Too Many Cinderellas by Growl Games. It's a winner.
Coming up next on The Dice Men Cometh, Paul Dean from Shut Up and Sit Down tells us about Paranoia, the RPG reboot, here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
You again. That was Bad Dreams with Home Life. We seem to have a theme going on because my home life certainly has given me bad dreams at the moment. You're on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with The Dice Men Cometh, Mark and Trent. Now coming up, now that I've stopped gushing over Too Many Cinderellas, did I tell you it's great? It's great.
Kickstarter.
Speaking of Kickstarters, Paul Dean, one half of the Shut Up and Sit Down team that produce videos, podcasts, their website. Look, if you know anything about board games, you would have heard about Shut Up and Sit Down. They've been an absolute phenomenon in our industry over the past 3 years.
They're a lot better than we are.
They sort of show us how to do it. Anyway, one half of Shut Up and Sit Down is Paul Dean. He's also involved with the Kickstarter reboot of the Paranoia RPG, and Trent spoke to him earlier this week.
Paranoia, one of the most influential and certainly one of the funniest RPGs ever, returns from Mongoose Publishing via a Kickstarter, which is now in its last few days. We're going to explore this. We're going to explain it for those who don't know. But first, I want to introduce one of the co-designers. And if you're a board gamer and you enjoy your online reviews, you'll know Paul Dean from Shut Up and Sit Down. He's the quiet one who talks more sense. Hello, Paul.
Hi, thanks for thinking that I talk sense.
We'll talk about the Paranoia role-playing game. This first came out way back in 1984. It was the height of the Cold War. You were too young for this when it first came out, surely, Paul?
I was too young for a lot of that kind of stuff. I would have been 4 years old, as I'm now 34. No, something like Paranoia, I wouldn't have got into. I wouldn't have bought into that kind of satire and the ridiculousness of it. I would have been playing Snakes and Ladders and probably a Thomas the Tank Engine board game, which I had when I was about 4 or 5.
Have you been tempted to go back and look up that Thomas the Tank Engine game on Board Game Geek?
Not until this conversation, and now I am, because because it was kind of a roll and move game, but there was an amount of, I think, junctions you could choose or things you could go down. And now I'm just interested as to how complex it really was.
Probably not very. Some of those things are best left in the memory, I think, Paul.
You might be right, actually. Okay.
So let's just explain Paranoia for anyone who doesn't know. The players are living in this claustrophobic underground city called Alpha Complex. It's managed by a supposedly benevolent computer that controls every aspect of life. The computer sends you on missions to root out traitors from various secret societies, while the players themselves are sometimes the traitors and always the first to accuse each other and many of the missions barely ever make it out of the briefing room. Would that be a fair summation?
I think that's a really good summation. The never making it out of the briefing room thing sounds almost tragic. I don't think I've ever had a game stall that much, but I have had games go chaotically wrong on the way to the job that you're supposed to do. You know, you never get there. That is the point that things fall apart in a way that nevertheless ends up being funny or challenging or a little bit ridiculous or all of those things thrown together.
Now, at the time this came out, the game totally broke the mold of the heroic D&D style adventure. It seems quite prescient in terms of modern games like Fiasco or even Werewolf. Would you agree?
I would, very much so. When I didn't get to play it until I was about 21, 22. When I played it, even then, with the sort of the landscape of role-playing games that were around then, it still stood out quite a bit and it was quite different. But I immediately grasped it. I understood that it was supposed to be about player dynamics, and it was supposed to be about an amount of cooperation and, I guess, being antagonistic, because you are supposed to be on the same side, and sometimes you need to be, but really you're not so much out for yourself as just covering your own back.
The reboot of Paranoia is under the stewardship of James Wallace, who's a grandmaster of English RPG creation and publishing. And the original designers of Paranoia are in the background as well. How did you get involved, Paul?
Well, I had known James for a little while. James runs an event in London called Game Camp, among the quite a lot of other things that he does that include writing and teaching and making games and all sorts. And I went to one or two game camps, bumped into him, had a chat, and found him just a very interesting guy. He's very agreeable. He's very pleasant in person. He's a guy who I have quite a high opinion of. And we'd sort of crossed paths one or two times over a couple of years. So we were in the same kind of spheres. And I started doing an RPG design diary on Shut Up and Sit Down, which I'm currently working on the next entry for. And James got in touch and actually just said something like, do you want to meet up and have a chat about this? I can't remember exactly the context of it now, but there was also a teaching job that he was talking about that he couldn't take, that he put me forward for, which turned out to be a lovely job about teaching games narrative and games writing. And he also said, I think we're going to be doing a Paranoia reboot. I'd really like to have you on.
At which point your eyes just lit up and... you know, I imagine you were floating a couple of inches off the floor, and yeah, it sounds exciting.
Were you there? Were you watching? I mean, that's kind of what happened. I'd not realized originally, when I'd first met James, I'd not realized how much stuff he'd done that I'd played. He's published quite a few games as well as designed them, and things like, I used to play the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay Enemy Within campaign, and I absolutely adored that, and I played that in my early 20s. I ran it. And so when you're sat there and you've just been having a chat with him saying, oh, well, when I ran Warhammer, this happened. And then he says to you, well, I'm hoping to do this. Would you like to be involved? It's a wonderful opportunity. It's really, really exciting.
Well, let's talk about some of the detail and some of those mechanics and the updating of the scenario. Because, of course, when it first came out, among the horrors that Paranoia predicted was 24-hour computer surveillance.
Yeah.
So now that that's come true... how has this been updated for the 21st century?
Well, we almost have a rich kind of texture around us that we can draw from in this way. That's, it's almost a bit depressing to talk about sometimes, or it's a bit ridiculous to consider. But we have that around us now. And we also have systems that are apparently monitoring all our internet and our data usage. And when you have a world kind of like that, that you live in, Paranoia can almost write itself as we are imagining it now. I mean, communism is just as a global entity to be scared of. It's an outdated concept. And so this is something sort of relevant, something with an awful lot of richness to it that we can draw on, you know, from our day-to-day lives. And unfortunately, it's also something with a kind of an amount of comic potential, because the classic question is, who watches The Watchmen? The question after that is, what if The Watchmen are not very good? Or they're just... you know, the Watchmen need to get home early. Have you ever seen Brazil?
Oh, yeah.
Terry Gilliam. Yes, you know, absolutely. A world in which a typo could be disastrous. You know, this is the kind of paranoia world that we could build.
And you mentioned the commies. They were, of course, center stage as the number one bad guy in the original. Terrorists have replaced commies in this one. And I imagine that's a bit of a fine line to tread, because you want to do it, you want to make sure the game's funny, but you don't want to do it distastefully either, particularly in London, where you've had some horrific events.
We very much have. And unfortunately, I've been, due to coincidences, some of those have been things I've not been terribly far away from at times. No, it's very important, obviously, to set the right kind of tone. But it's not necessarily that there are even terrorists present, or that you will ever see one, or that there will be acts of terrorism. It's more about the fear that something will happen, and an element of, I suppose, the justification of behavior that comes out of that.
All right, well, let's talk mechanics. You're using a combination of D6s and cards, and the presence of the cards seems to have some of the fans of the game a little bit worried that they're going to be somehow hemmed into predetermined situations or a limited number of gadgets. It maybe doesn't sound as open as an RPG should be. Can you talk to that at all?
Yeah, I don't think people need to be too worried. The idea is we want to introduce something that's a little bit different to make combat faster and a little more unpredictable. But this isn't something that should dominate the game, really, or that I will sort of destabilize classic paranoia. At the moment, we've really, really pared down stats. So there are about 16 different things, or 16 different areas that you are good at doing stuff in. And we'll have combat where people can play cards to do certain very special things, some of which might be tied to their mutant powers. It might be a card that you'll actually be holding, you know, all the time close to your chest. So people always know there's something about you, but they might not know what until you do a particular thing. It's not something that we think will really destabilize the game or massively change the sort of the way that it plays, but something that adds a few little things in that players can do, especially because we want quick combat rounds. We want people choosing their cards quickly, putting them down, and that hopefully will keep people on their toes a little bit more and make the game maybe a little more chaotic, a little more unpredictable.
There's a lot of talk of fast-paced tactical action in this reboot.
Yes.
I hope that's not at the expense of character. I mean, you're not going all 4th edition D&D on us and turning it into a video game.
Good heavens, no. No. I don't have... If people enjoy D&D 4th, I think that's fine. I was not a very big fan of it myself. No, we still want people to have secret society backgrounds, mutant powers, and very much still be their own person. But we want combat to be fast and a little bit chaotic and a little bit unpredictable at times, which we think fits the kind of theme of the game anyway. You suddenly combat begins, there might be 3, 4, 5 other people around the table. How much do you trust them? What are they going to do? Who is going to screw things up this time? That kind of atmosphere. All of that obviously still refereed very much by the GM, who has quite an amount of artistic license here.
Well, I do wonder how easy this is to run. We've talked a lot about it being a classic game, but is there something in this that makes it a good first RPG for newbies, for millennials, or is it going to appeal to them, do you think?
We very much hope so, and we think so. Part of the design philosophy has been paring things down. We'd like something that you can buy, you can take home, and you can play on the day that you bought it. That's the part of the philosophy behind having fewer stats and having fewer skills. I don't think you really need to legislate a lot of the politics or the specifics. And certainly when you get a group of people together and they're playing, they very much understand the social dynamics of what they're doing. And people know about covering their backsides and about lying and about cheating and about half-truths and about the problem of getting in trouble with an enormous authority. We've all had that, whether that's with the police or our parents or whatever. And we don't need to build a huge amount around that. We need to build a sort of a sandbox that allows that to happen.
So we're going to come back with more Paul Dean in a minute. He's going to tell us a bit more about Shut Up and Sit Down and the podcast empire that is that.
I want to apologize for the sound quality on this recording on my microphone. He sounds better than what I do, and he was Skyping me from Texas, so I don't know what's going on with that. I've bought a new microphone.
Oh.
I'm building a voice booth.
Were you going to tell me about this?
I'm actually building a studio in my home.
Oh.
Seriously, to do these
that
interviews.
That is serious.
Absolutely.
No more half-assed recordings for you.
Oh, well, we're going to hear the second half of this half-assed recording next on The Dice Men Cometh. Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
The Givers with I Saw You First, Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh. They're going to go soon, I'm sure. I was going to make a joke about how all the women that I never met saw me first, and that's why I never met them.
Oh,
but I think
to,
I'm going
I'm
to steer clear
joke.
Of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no,
anyway,
thanks for now, that. That's a good idea.
Now, Paul and Trent are back, and Paul's going to tell us a bit more about Shut Up and Sit Down.
Paranoia seems to sit very well within your ethos for Shut Up and Sit Down, where you and Quinn, you spend a lot of time talking about story and the emergent narrative, you know, not just from RPGs, but from board games as well. Is it not enough just to roll some dice and be pushing some cubes around in an efficient manner anymore?
It can be. There's no accounting for taste, some people say, which in my philosophy is it's absolutely fine for you to like what you like and you know, enjoy what you enjoy. I mean, if someone has a hankering for classic Paranoia, there's absolutely no need for them, for example, to buy another version of Paranoia then. But I don't know, I feel like gaming has become even more social. A lot of tabletop gaming has further emphasized the kind of the, what I call the social and the organic, which is elements of bluffing, elements of deception, elements of misleading people. And I feel like this and occasionally story-based things seem to be more prominent than they were in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, there's definitely been an evolution.
I'm sure there has. And I wonder if it's partly because now that we've got the internet, if, you know, we used to local co-op play a lot of video games. Local co-op in video games is starting to come back again on the indie scene. But for a long time, it was just gone, and we'd just be able to play games online with people that we weren't around, we didn't see. But video games are not great at AI when AI needs to do things like understand context and bluff and, you know, do a lot of things that a human does in social interaction. Board games, role-playing games are the perfect arena for that kind of thing to happen in. So I guess this ties back to more of our general philosophy this time, is we want to pare down systems and just put people around a table and let their personalities come out and let people be people and enjoy an hour or two of wicked deception and bluffing and lying and backstabbing and betrayal and all that sort of thing.
It sounds like a good...
But if you want to play Agricola, that's okay.
You and Quinns were freelancing in video game journalism and other bits and pieces for a few years, but it sounds like you've found a bit of a home in Shut Up and Sit Down. Is the website and board games now a full-time gig for you guys?
It pretty much is. It's something that we'd actually shared a real interest in role-playing stuff. I've known Quinns for about 10 years now, and we did D&D and a few other role-playing things when we first knew each other. And we'd always played quite a few tabletop games, actually. It'd always been part of our history, as well as playing video games. But, you know, there was no coverage for them, and there was no one talking about them. Even though we were aware that it was building up, we could see that more board games were available and that, you know, they were just doing better and people were playing them more often. They were more visible. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess we have kind of settled into a new home doing this, and it is something that takes up a lot of our time now. We still freelance for other places. You might see Quinns on Kotaku. You might see me on Eurogamer or all kinds of other places where we pop up, and we both still play video games a lot and talk about them. But this has grown into quite a thing. I think much more of a thing than we imagined it would be when we started nearly 3.5 years ago, and we wanted to kind of be inspired by Consolevania, which was a Scottish show about on the internet about video games that was just pretty lo-fi but quite well informed, and we wanted to do that for board games and just do the same kind of lo-fi thing, but if we had intelligent stuff today to say, if we made games look interesting, we thought that'd do the job. But it turns out lots of other people have kind of been feeling the same, and you know, Tabletop appeared, Board with Life appeared, lots of other board game related media started to appear on the internet. People are talking about more board games more than ever. Video game designers are talking about board games all the time now, and about ideas that they take from those. Yeah, I guess it's a home for us, and we're very lucky. We have subscribers and donors who pledge to us, and we're able to work on this a lot of the time, or most of the time. And I should point this out while I am on the record, is you'll see us doing a couple of things sort of every day a week, and you'll see me doing a couple of things on the site. See Matt doing that. Quinns does an awful lot of work behind the scenes as well.
Yeah.
And Quinns is sometimes possibly arguably more than a full-time person, because he does an awful lot of the unglamorous legwork of just doing emails and just doing admin and just making sure that the site functions. Mm. Same for things like we have Josh, who's our designer, and Mike, who's our programmer and who creates a lot of the business. A lot of credit has to go to absolutely everyone who does stuff. So much stuff behind the camera happens all the time now, editing, writing, preparation.
Yeah, but you're the one that gets the trip to Texas for Board Game Geek Con, though, aren't you? I mean,
that's where I am right now, which is great. Mm. Quinn's popped by here last year. We all went to Gen Con this year, which was a wonderful opportunity. It was really good. But the reception of people has been incredible. Our community has been incredibly nice to us. And while we're not, I wouldn't at all say that we're rich, because we make some money, but obviously it has to be divided up between lots of people, and we pay our taxes, and well, God, I hope we do. We're a legitimate business. We can afford to pay, you know, to fly ourselves to out to an event, and we can pay to fly me out to Board Game Geek, where hopefully I'll be making a bit of video content, interviewing people, maybe getting some good news for next week. And that's a little bit of a privilege, really.
And would there be any chance of a trip out to Australia for any conceivable reason?
I don't know. Possibly. Certainly we may do. I should point out, if you hear something that sounds like a cat, it is a cat. It's just, it's not me making weird noises. There are a number of cats here and I can't control them.
Okay, I assume you're not staying in a sort of cat-themed hotel then.
No, I'm actually in one of the apartments that belongs to a couple of the Board with Life team, who are very kindly putting me up in a spare room, which is fantastic.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But they're cats. As I say, we have a budget, but we're not super rich, so we try to be careful with how we spend our cash.
Yeah.
And it's very nice to fly out here but not worry about too much what's on the bottom line.
Well, we're certainly fans of what you guys are doing and the Board with Life crew. And Paul Dean from Shut Up and Sit Down, it's been a real pleasure talking to you on the Dice Man Cometh. Mate, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I'm really sorry if you can hear a cat fight in the background, because that's now happening. And a cat is kicking another cat in the head. This is ridiculous.
Oh my God, get out there and lay down some bets, quick.
That was Shut Up and Sit Down's Paul Dean in the middle of a literal, not a metaphorical, cat fight in Texas when we spoke last week. He was a lovely bloke, and there was more of that chat. We might get to that at some point. But look, the Paranoia RPG, it's on Kickstarter now in the last few days, going back.
That sounds fantastic. Great. And look, those guys at Shut Up and Sit Down, I just love them. They are funny. They put out good stuff, great quality videos, their podcast. They just can't get enough of them.
But look, right here and now, you're stuck with us.
Yes, that's right.
Sorry, and we've got just 1 or 2 minutes left, and we're going to talk a little bit of board gaming news before we get out of here, and that's coming up next on Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
That was most of the Killjoys with some of their free falling. The clock's ticking away. Trent, we have got half a minute of half-assed news, go.
Yeah, sorry, we're running out of time, and there's a bit of board gaming news around on releases and stuff like that, but it's all overshadowed by, well, a story that's kind of been forgotten in amongst all the furor over the merger of Asmodee and Fantasy Flight. So a little bit of business news. Hasbro, in the background, while all this was going on with Fantasy Flight...
You mean Hasbro.
That's... Sorry, is that Darth Vader?
The Evil Empire, yeah.
Okay.
Bring the Monopoly to me.
Can you stop that? Because we've got like no time and you're just... Okay, Hasbro has been in talks with another company to merge themselves, DreamWorks Animation.
Oh my God.
I know, Hasbro and DreamWorks Animation have been in talks to become one company.
Oh, geez.
For one to buy the other. But... it's all off.
Oh.
It's not happening.
Thank goodness. They would have taken over the world.
The merger talks have been hitherto, or thus far, I don't know, one of those, unsuccessful. It would have given Hasbro a lot more media presence.
Say, does DreamWorks own Disney?
No. No, Disney owns Disney. DreamWorks is
Sony owns Disney, don't they?
No, DreamWorks is Geffen and Spielberg
Katzenberg, yes.
All those cats,
yeah.
Right, okay. And look, the
SKG, yeah.
The problem appeared to be that DreamWorks wanted $3 billion. Okay? And so the whole thing's just off. It's just way too much. Stock has fallen. So we're just going to have to watch this space to see if those two companies can actually get their act together. But what it basically means is that we've lost out on the chance to get more films made out of board games because those have gone so incredibly well.
That's right.
So far.
D&D.
Did anybody see Battleship?
Oh, yeah. I didn't even bother with that one.
Okay, that's it. That's us. We're out of here. This is The Dice Man Cometh. Go a thing. We'll catch you next week for our 50th episode.
Woo! 50!
On Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
Half ton.
This has been an edit of The Dice Man Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.